actually makes one more dangerous. So we're basically just warning about danger. We're not making diagnoses. We're calling for an evaluation. I hear that Mr. Trump is undergoing a physical exam in January. I hope it includes a screen for mental capacity, the capacity to serve, the basic ability to take in correct information and advice when needed, to process that information, to make sound, logical decisions based on facts and real consequences.
As we wrap up, how does this relate to the issue of impeachment?
In my mind, well, that's really not my area. My expertise is in medicine and psychiatry and violence prevention. But when I met with the lawmakers, it seemed that while the 25th Amendment would be the only area that deals with presidential disability, even that is a political decision. In other words, in courts or for legal bodies, we give our expert opinion based on medical data, but all we do is give recommendations. The disability or unfitness for duty, these things are still legal decisions in all circumstances. It seems in this case it would be a political decision whereby it can play a role.
We're going to do part two of this discussion and put it in our web exclusives at democracynow.org. Dr. Bandy Lee, forensic psychiatrist, internationally recognized expert on violence, editor of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. She is an organizer of the Yale University Duty to Warn Conference at the Yale Medical School. Happy birthday, Carla Wills. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your Friday evening news. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. Open daily December 16th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade arts, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at 2 Southwest Ankeny in Waterfront Park. Information at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler tells Housing Secretary Ben Carson to do his job.
Oregon Democratic Governor Kate Brown and Republican gubernatorial hopeful Newt Bueller are both opposed to the same parts of the GOP tax plan.
Oregonians react to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's plan to cut back the size of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 8th, 2017, the 322nd day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Oregon Democratic Governor Kate Brown and Republican gubernatorial hopeful Newt Bueller have both come out in opposition to a key component of the Republican tax plan. Both want to preserve deductions for state and local property tax. And both are putting pressure on Greg Walden, Oregon's lone Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives. Both the House and Senate versions of the tax plan eliminate the deduction for state income tax and limit the property tax deduction to $10,000, which would result in a significant federal tax hike for thousands of Oregonians. And like leaders in other high-tax states, they're concerned about the impact on Oregon's economy and the ability to generate revenue necessary to support the state's social programs. In a statement, Bueller said, quote, "I'm hopeful that Oregon's seven members of Congress in the final legislation can protect the interests of Oregonians, including the deductibility of state income taxes," end quote. Yesterday, the governor's office called Walden to express opposition to the proposed tax law and request that Congress retain both state and local income and property tax deductions. Walden voted for the current House tax and has not given any indication of whether or not he will consider the governor's request.
On Wednesday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler essentially told Housing Secretary Ben Carson that it was time for him to start doing his job or get out of the way. During an interview on National Public Radio, Carson responded to a question about affordable housing by saying, quote, "We just need to move away from the concept that only the government can solve this problem," unquote. He made the statement as Republicans in Congress consider whether to reduce or eliminate tax incentives for affordable housing as part of their new tax bill. Responding via Twitter, Wheeler said that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development should, quote, "step up to the plate and create a real solution for our housing crisis," end quote. He pointed out that these projects cannot happen without federal help and suggested that Carson let someone else take up the task of leadership. Because of the potential loss of affordable housing tax breaks associated with the Republican tax plan, the city is accelerating development timelines for its affordable housing projects. Construction on a new 203-unit affordable housing project on the South Waterfront is scheduled to start in January. The city said that other projects are in the pipeline, which will be announced soon.
Employees of New Seasons have filed a complaint alleging that two union organizers have been illegally fired and that company management has intimidated other workers. Pro-union employees have been attempting to organize a union for about a month, complaining that New Seasons has reduced health care plans and that wages are insufficient for Portland's cost of living. They have filed their complaint with B-Lab, the nonprofit that evaluates and awards B Corporation certificates. New Seasons is a B Corporation and as such has to meet standards of social and environmental performance as well as accountability and transparency. The employee's complaint states that the company has violated the terms of its B Corp certification in part by hiring Cruz and Associates, a law firm with an anti-union history. The statement notes that the firm was also used by the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas to, quote, intimidate pro-union workers, end quote, according to the release. In a statement, New Seasons employee Sean Lilly said, quote, "The company has chosen to spend their money on union busting versus actually living up to their branding as an employee-friendly, sustainable business," end quote. In a statement to Willamette Week, New Seasons said it had hired Cruz and Associates to conduct information sessions to help inform them about the unionizing process. Employees behind the complaint dispute that claim.
Oregonians are having a strong, and for the most part negative, reaction to a proposal from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to cut back the size of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. For more, we have this story from the Oregon News Service. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is calling on the president to reduce the size of Oregon's Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. What that reduction will look like for Cascade Siskiyou as well as Nevada's Gold Butte isn't yet clear. It comes on the heels of President Donald Trump's announcement on Monday to slash about 2 million acres from Utah's Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. In a press call on Tuesday, Zinke said past presidents had, quote, "abused their powers," end quote, when designating and expanding monuments. But State Representative Pam Marsh says Cascade Siskiyou has broad local support and that state and local officials plan to push back on this decision.
We think the whole idea of shrinking the monument in any way is a bad idea. We are gearing up to resist, and we're doing that on a statewide basis. The monument has the support of our two U.S. senators, the governor of Oregon, quite a different political environment than in some other states.
Marsh also refutes Zinke's claims that the monument status affects private land use within its boundaries. She says local and state laws dictate what landowners can do on their property. Cascade Siskiyou was created in 2000 and expanded in 2017. Marsh says Southern Oregon is dependent on tourism, and Cascade Siskiyou is a key component of that.
The economic environment as a whole benefits from the monument. That's a benefit that only grows over time, as the monument really starts to be much more in the public focus.
The monument is recognized as one of the most biologically diverse regions in the country. Opponents of the reduction say they plan legal action against the Trump administration over this decision. This has been a story from the Oregon News Service. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Cascade Siskiyou National Monument is southeast of Ashland with about 5,000 acres in California and 80,000 in Oregon. It was nearly doubled in size by President Obama at the beginning of this year based on broad agreement among ecologists that the monument needed to be larger to perform its function of protecting the Cascade Siskiyou ecosystem. Shannon Brown, one of the group of friends of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, spoke to KABU in August about what makes the area so interesting to scientists and nature lovers.
It is sort of the epicenter of many different regions coming together. The high elevation Cascades, the Siskiyou Mountains, which are really old rocks and bring their own flora and fauna into play. The Great Basin Range to the east, which is much drier and more sagebrush, junipers, things like that. And then you also have sort of the northern most extent of the California Chaparral region. So it's just this epicenter of all these different places coming together, which creates an extreme number of different flora and fauna, different species interacting, and that's where we get high biodiversity.
The mountains are also home to mostly dormant industries, including timber and mining, as well as cattle grazing. The two recent reductions of monuments in Utah have been hailed by some local Republican lawmakers as examples of the federal government listening to local concerns. In an editorial yesterday, the Salem Statesman Journal noted that Utah and Oregon are very different places and reminded Zinke that Oregonians are overwhelmingly against reducing the size of the monument. For example, State Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum cited the 1906 Antiquities Act and threatened to take legal action if Zinke's plan moves ahead. The Antiquities Act gives the president the power to create and enlarge a national monument, but the power to remove that designation rests with Congress.
The holiday spirit of giving has taken hold of at least one local resident. Yesterday, the Salvation Army announced that an anonymous donor had placed $10,000 in cash in one of the familiar red buckets outside the Fred Meyer store on Northeast Widler Street. The donation came in the form of 100 $100 bills and is the largest single cash contribution that the charitable organization has received in the Portland area during this holiday season. Group officers said that it was not unusual to get the occasional $100 bill, but to get $10,000 in a single red bucket was very unusual. Marcos Marquez, an officer in the Salvation Army's Moore Street Corps, said, quote, "While we do not know who put the money in the kettle, they should know that we are very grateful to have received such a generous donation," end quote. The Salvation Army is a 150-year-old Protestant charity organization. It is the second largest charity in the United States, operating food pantries and shelters for women and children, as well as veterans shelter among its many services.
Allegations of sexual misconduct have begun to hit both parties in Congress, taking out some conservative and some progressive favorites. Now we're finding that taxpayer money has been used to pay congressional sexual harassment settlements, and most observers think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. But what about the abuser-in-chief? KABU's Ray Bodwell has his thoughts.
Today I am announcing that in the coming weeks I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
And with that, Minnesota Senator Al Franken announced his pending resignation. I must confess that I have been a fan of Senator Franken. In his 8 years in Washington, he was consistently rated as one of the most progressive members of the Senate. He was a favorite of labor unions, environmentalists, educators, veterans, seniors, and almost any group that you would define as socially liberal. He is hated by the oil and gas industry, Right to Life advocates, the American Conservative Union, and religious fundamentalists. And in what may be the ultimate irony, he received consistently high marks from women's rights organizations. But his track record was not enough to save him, and despite the fact that he had immediately submitted himself to a Senate ethics review and denied most of the allegations against him, he was becoming a distraction to Democrats, who quickly turned on him en masse. So yesterday he publicly leaned in and took one for the team, as the saying goes, and ultimately that may have been the right thing to do. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton is likely to name someone suitably liberal to replace him. And by sticking around, Franken would have continued to provide an attractive target for Republicans trying to create a distraction so the general population doesn't focus on their disastrous agenda. But as Franken himself points out, his alleged transgressions pale in comparison to a couple of high-profile Republicans.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
Despite the multiple allegations of sexual assault on underage women and behavior that was so widely recognized that he was barred from a shopping mall where teenage girls were likely to hang out, Alabama Republican Roy Moore has received the endorsement of Donald Trump, and his campaign is being funded by the Republican Party. As for Trump, does anyone forget this classic soundbite?
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. It just, I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it.
You may recall that in a tape he goes on to brag about grabbing women by their genitals. When the tape surfaced, he claimed that it was, quote, just locker room talk, but he's now floating the idea that the voice we hear on the tape isn't his. Really? Sure sounds like him to me. And his old buddy, Billy Bush, has recently reconfirmed that it is indeed Trump. Make no mistake, holding powerful men accountable for sexual intimidation and assault is absolutely the right thing to do, and it is long overdue. But we can't just look at a few congressional resignations or decisions not to run again and think that the job is done in the federal government. There's an old saying that the fish rots from the head down, and there's still a foul stench that comes out of the Oval Office. For KBOO, I'm Ray Bodwell.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by the return of Bread and Roses at 6. Welcome back. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the mid-40s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can also expect a partly cloudy day, but temperatures will only reach the mid-30s. On this date, in 1886, 26 craft unions came together to form the American Federation of Labor. Samuel Gompers was elected as the AFL's first president. The quote of the day is from legendary U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, quote, "Strong, responsible unions are essential to industrial fair play. Without them, the labor bargain is wholly one-sided," end quote.
Yesterday, former South Carolina police officer Michael Slager was sentenced to 20 years in prison for second-degree murder and obstruction of justice. In April 2015, Slager fatally shot Walter Scott, an unarmed black man, as he fled a routine traffic stop. 3 days after the shooting, a witness posted a video online of Slager shooting Scott multiple times in the back as Scott ran away. The footage of Scott's death sparked protests and demonstrations in South Carolina and across the country, and Slager was arrested on murder charges shortly after the clip went viral. Last December, a state murder trial for Slager ended in a mistrial. Those charges were later dropped after Slager agreed to plead guilty to the federal charge of violating Scott's civil rights. Judge David Norton sentenced Slager to 20 years after determining that the shooting constituted second-degree murder and Scott's false testimony amounted to obstruction of justice. Anthony Scott, the older brother of the deceased Scott, told reporters that he accepted Norton's decision, saying, quote, "At the end of the day, there's nothing Judge Slager has to face." Let me restate that. "At the end of the day, there's another judge Slager has to face," end quote.
The sentencing of Slager in the murder of Walter Scott has been met with approval by many Americans, but the guilty verdict and substantial prison term are both anomalies. There are few people in Oregon more painfully aware of this fact than the families that make up the group Pacific Northwest Family Circle. For more, I filed this report this afternoon.
Pacific Northwest Family Circle is a group dedicated to mutual support and advocacy by people who have lost relatives to police violence in the greater Portland area. In this clip from a forum on police accountability last Friday on KBOO, member Maria Hammer describes how the group helped her in the wake of the shooting of her brother Chase by Salem police in 2012 and the following four-year legal battle.
I wouldn't be here today if I wouldn't have made the connection to the Pacific Northwest Family Circle. And so just on their behalf, you know, they are, you know, comprised of some amazing, strong women and some great families. And I just, you know, invite you to connect with them on Facebook or connect with them via email. It's pnwfamilycircle@gmail.com. And they're just here for support and to connect to resources. And I just can't thank them enough for, you know, having such welcoming arms to me.
Pacific Northwest Family Circle has a number of events coming up this weekend and next week, including the monthly vigil for Keaton Otis, a 25-year-old black man shot by several Portland officers in 2010. The vigils are held on the 12th of each month. That's this coming Tuesday, at 6:30 p.m. at the corner of Northeast 6th and Halsey, where Otis was shot. They're also taking part in the National Feet to the Fire campaign to hold district attorneys accountable for, quote, protecting us from police violence. Multnomah County District Attorneys, including current DA Rod Underhill, have long been accused of going easy on officers during grand jury hearings following officer-involved shootings. Underhill himself is also responsible for a secret memo early this year that discouraged the city and bureau investigators from immediately interviewing officers following shootings. This led to Officer Samson Ajir, who shot Terrell Johnson in May, not being interviewed by anyone about the shooting for weeks. This coming Monday, the 11th, Family Circle will be at the Clackamas County Courthouse, along with members of Don't Shoot Portland and Surge, or Standing Up for Racial Justice, at 10 a.m., It's part of monthly demonstrations being held as part of the Feet to the Fire campaign, each at a courthouse in Oregon where families are fighting for justice. The group is also involved in the growing PDX Billboard project, based off of a similar effort in Wisconsin, to create billboards and bench ads calling attention to victims of police violence in the area and the systems that fail to hold officers accountable. They will be holding fundraisers throughout the next few months. More info can be found at pdxbillboardproject.com. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Donald Trump has come under attack from allies and adversaries for Wednesday's announcement to formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He made the move despite decades of U.S. policy that promoted a two-state solution in the region. British Prime Minister Theresa May strongly disagreed with Trump's decision, saying that the fate of the city should be decided as, quote, a negotiated settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, end quote. Saudi Arabia's government called it an irresponsible and unwanted step, and Iranian President Rouhani denounced it as, quote, new adventurism by global oppressors, end quote. Not surprisingly, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu thanked Trump for his, quote, just and courageous decision, end quote. With the announcement, leaders from both sides warned of heightened tension, and today there were violent clashes in the region. And now we go live to Jenka Soderberg, who is on site at the protest vigil downtown for Vigil for Jerusalem, for a quick update.
Thanks, Linda. Here on the corner of Southwest 3rd and Madison, there's probably 200 people chanting Free Free Palestine, and the issue that people are dealing with are the attacks and nonviolent demonstrators that have taken place today. More than 800 people have been injured in the protests across Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, and two people have been killed. I'm here with Ned Roche, who's one of the organizers here with Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, and he can tell us why people are coming out here today.
Well, I think people are out here today because we're totally outraged. you know, if we're ever going to have peace and justice in the issue of Palestine, this is not the way to go about it. For Israel to unilaterally declare that Jerusalem is 100% Israeli and the Palestinians have no rights, no place, no history, no future, this will never lead to anything but ultimate bloodshed. That what we need is we need the establishment in Palestine of a Palestinian state so that Palestinians can raise families, can bring up children, can have a life like people throughout the world where they are proud, they have history, and this whole idea that Israel controls all of Jerusalem and all of Palestine and the Palestinians have no rights, that just needs to go.
And today, how is the response downtown as others are seeing your protest, and how is the response from law enforcement?
How's the response to the protest?
What's the response? Well, the response to the protest right here in downtown, it's pretty active. It's pretty alive. You know, there's no wall, no ban, no embassy on stolen land. It's the cheer that's happening right now. And as Jenka said, there are 200 people shouting at the tops of their lungs.
Ed Roche, for giving us this update on the vigil down there. And Jenka, thank you very much. This is a vigil going down on 3rd and Madison in opposition to Trump's announcement about considering Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. And now back to our regular news.
Yesterday, Georgia Representative and civil rights icon John Lewis announced that he won't attend the opening of the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum on Saturday. The reason? Because President Donald Trump will be there. In a joint statement with Mississippi Representative Benny Thompson, Lewis said, quote, "President Trump's attendance and his hurtful policies are an insult to the people portrayed in this civil rights museum," end quote. Lewis was a key civil rights leader in the 1960s as chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, referring to Trump's past comments about women, immigrants, and NFL players who have protested during the national anthem before games. Lewis and Thompson said his remarks disrespect the efforts of civil rights leaders. The statement by Lewis and Thompson followed Tuesday's announcement by the NAACP that they were opposed to Trump attending the museum opening because he has created a, quote, racially hostile climate. Lewis has been a frequent critic of Trump and drew the president's wrath before his inauguration when he said that he didn't consider him to be a legitimate president.
Officially, 62 people died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria. But an analysis by the New York Times says that the actual death count from the September storm may be over 15 times higher. The Times analysis found that in the 42 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall, 1,052 more people than usual died across the island. The estimate was calculated by comparing the number of deaths for each day in 2017 with the average of the number of deaths for the same days in 2015 and 2016. The Category 4 storm with winds of 150 miles per hour hit the island's 3.4 million American citizens on September 20th. In a November interview, Wanda Lovett, the director of the Demographic Registry in Puerto Rico, stated that prior to that day, she had an average of 82 deaths a day. But by mid-November, she was seeing an average of 118 deaths a day. The deadliest day was September 25th, the day the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo A. Rosello, warned that a looming humanitarian crisis could prompt a mass exodus from the island. It was over 90 degrees and power was out on most of the island. On that day, 135 people died in Puerto Rico. By comparison, 75 people died on that day in 2016 and 60 in 2015. One local mayor went to the Federal Emergency Management Agency command post that day and shouted for help. Statistics show his city, Manati, had among the highest mortality rates in September. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenka Soderberg, Ray Bodwell, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, coming up Monday morning, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's More Talk Radio. Cecil and Celeste take your calls. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with Willamette River keeper Travis Williams about what the EPA's latest delay tactics mean for the health of the Willamette River. And at 11, it's Health Watch, Natural Remedies for Menopause Symptoms with Dana Lavoie. And at 11:30, Radio Zine presents Making Contact and the Ghosts of the Korean War. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Sam. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.